It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about the summer training regimen of a world champion speed skater as the most promising speed skaters in the country converge at the Pettit National Ice Center in Milwaukee for a development camp set to get underway today. Call in with a question or comment about speed skating, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Bob Corby is a former U.S. Olympic speed skating coach, came out of retirement to coach Keewaskum's Jordan Stoles. Bob, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you.
Good morning. And Jordan Stoles is here as well, Olympic and world champion speed skater, becoming first man to win gold in three individual races at the World Single Distances Speed Skating Championships earlier this year. Jordan, welcome.
Hey, thank you for having me.
So at the World Speed Skating Championships, you defeat Dutch world record holder in the 1500 meters, Kjeld Nuis. What was it like beating the top Dutch skater in front of a crowd of more than 12,000 Dutch fans?
Well, it was super unexpected, I guess, but definitely a really crazy thing that happened, I guess, in their minds, because usually the Dutch are always on top. So I think beating them and then seeing Kjeld's face at the end of the race was, I guess, something to see, you know, something, you know, I didn't think was going to happen, especially for the third win. And I was racing, so I didn't get to really experience much of the fans, but I think Bob did, so.
I wonder, did you talk with Kjeld after at all? Did you exchange any words?
No.
Okay.
No.
Bob, what was it like for you in that moment?
Well, it was pretty amazing because the Dutch fans are very knowledgeable. So if someone is doing a good performance, they go crazy and screaming, even if the skater is not Dutch. And when they are Dutch, then it's deafening. You can't even hear someone standing next to you talking. So it was just so exciting. And then to have him do so well was it's about as much fun as you can have.
They just like to light up the track and see a good performance, it sounds like.
Yes.
So
even in warm-ups, he was getting ovations when he would skate by.
Oh, so, wow. Jordan, how did that feel?
I guess like a sense of that the people there like me. So definitely made me feel super good that, you know, they're cheering for the Dutch and for me, even though we're just fighting back and forth. So,
Bob, put this into perspective for us. So Jordan sets track record in men's 1500 meters last season in Norway, goes on to win junior world titles. And then what comes next is really jaw-dropping. Three golds in worlds, all before age 19. How does he compare to past American speed skating champions?
Well, he's right up there with the top. Eric Tiden did something similar when he was 18, and Shawnee Davis, of course, was good at that age, too. Dan Jansen was really good at that age. But so Jordan is right up there with some very good company.
Can you walk us through a typical day in the life of Jordan Stoles in terms of how you keep up your training this time of year and what it's like?
Yeah, well, I think with the motive, me or Bob?
Oh, Jordan, go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. I guess staying motivated throughout the summer is a pretty big thing, but, you know, just trying to train as much as I can working with Bob. So a typical day in the life of me is waking up, eating, and then going for a bike ride. So
how many miles?
I try and get a few rides in a week at about 70 miles. So.
Okay. What does the bike conditioning do for your speed skating?
So I guess aerobically, and you can also do it anaerobically, but it's just you're biking for so much longer than you are skating. So it really helps once you get back on the ice because it just conditions you so well, especially if you're trying to do all around or if you're trying to, you know, just improve your basic fitness.
What about those leg muscles, which we see, you know, when as spectators are just in a maze of the sheer amount of energy and muscle that goes into these performances? How do you build up the strength?
Yeah, I mean, weightlifting along with that, too. And we do other things like sandbag lifting where we put 50 pounds on your back and then just do as many single leg squats as you can and do that a few times. So I guess just finding multiple ways to condition your legs and get as strong as possible.
Bob, are you piling sandbags on Jordan?
Yes, occasionally I do. But he has no trouble lifting the sandbags. So.
Do you direct Jordan's conditioning, or does he kind of set his own conditioning agenda?
No, they get specific workout programs beginning 2 weeks after the skating season is over, and they've been doing about 12 workouts a week, two-a-day workouts. In addition to biking every day, he lifts weights and runs up ski hills, and it's pretty really tough training.
Do you dream up these workouts?
Yes, it's a combination of... a combination of what we did years ago and then a few innovations.
Oh, that's interesting, because you have such longevity in the sport. What does conditioning look like now and then, decades later? What are some older things that have stayed on versus what's new now?
A couple of things. The sandbag weights were different. I think those came in. People started thinking like, oh, that's just old school, but I reintroduced them. And then also doing something called turn skate, where you have the person leaning on a band and you're simulating centrifugal force. And then they do turn skates for 10, 12 minutes at a time.
I'm going to reintroduce you both here as we talk about speed skating and world champion Wisconsin native Jordan Stolz with us. Coach Bob Corby, former U.S. Olympic speed skating coach, you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions. Jordan, do you ever raise an eyebrow about what Bob is having you do with conditioning?
Only when I start to get tired and we're about 2.5 weeks in. And then... still got 5 days left, and it's looking pretty tough, but that's what's fun about it. So
you never know where the conditioning might take you next.
Right, exactly.
You know, in terms of the awards coming in, semifinalist for the Amateur Athletic Union's James E. Sullivan Award goes to the most outstanding American college or Olympic athlete. Previous winner of that award was Eric Heiden, another really decorated U.S. speed skater from Wisconsin. How does it feel to be in that company and recognized among such accomplished speed skaters?
Yeah, as for, I guess, the awards part of it, I guess it's kind of bringing popularity back to skating. But so it's a really, I guess, cool thing that I was able to get the award, because I guess if Eric Heiden got it, that was many years ago, probably 40 years ago. So bringing that back and having, I guess, that name be kind of mixed in with mine is a really cool, you know, kind of thing happening. Even if I'm not quite as good as Eric Heiden, there's it's still cool to be named up with, you know, the top skaters in the world. So I really appreciate it.
Bob, do you mind tweaking that language quite as good? It sounds like that you're on a different trajectory here.
Well, everyone recognizes Eric as being the greatest skater who ever lived, to win 5 out of 5 races at one Olympics. That's always like the most unbelievable thing that an athlete could do. But he is doing some things that Eric did, like at the younger ages. And so it is really impressive to even be considered in the same breath as Eric Heiden.
What did you see in Jordan to come out of retirement? What did you see in this teenager that convinced you to say, you know what, I'm going to step up as coach?
Well, I had only seen him when he was a young skater. And then when he called and asked me to train, I could not turn him down. Plus I was winding down my PT practice a little bit, so I had more time. And so watching him skate every day was pretty unbelievable. He's a phenomenal athlete. And then you ask him to, oh, here, try this. And then he comes around the next time and it's all completely fixed. So he's extremely coachable. And then that didn't count the training. Then the next summer when we added in the conditioning in the summer, that's when I knew that he was really destined for great things.
Jordan, you started skating on the pond behind your house when you were 5 while wearing a life vest, no less. What was that process like of transitioning then to training on the oval at the Pettit Center in Milwaukee?
Well, it's kind of something we would do, I think, like once a week when we were skating short track. But transitioning, I guess, I always felt better in the long track once I started getting older, like 11 years old. So it wasn't like that big of a thing. You know, it was just something that all the other skaters did, because we'd have some Olympians on the short track that were coaching and then some on the long track. And yeah, we would jump in, and I felt more comfortable on the long track. So I just wanted to stick with that. And then I kept progressing. My times came down, and then I was able to win the U.S. championships. And then after that, it's just been kept on going. So
do you have preferences of being indoors or outdoors?
For sure indoors.
For sure indoors, because everything is controlled on the track. Controlled conditions.
Yeah, good ice, no wind.
Oh, Jordan Stoles with us, world champion speed skater. Picking his brain, Wisconsin native Bob Corby with us, as well as coach in the Milwaukee area. You can join in at any point. Call in with a question or comment at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn how Wisconsin is helping to develop the next generation of elite speed skaters as the Pettit National Ice Center in Milwaukee's Junior Development Camp gets underway. Be part of the conversation. Call in with a question or a comment at 800-642-1234. Native of Kewaskum, Jordan Stoles is an Olympic and world champion speed skater, stays with us. Bob Corby, his coach, former U.S. Olympic speed skating coach and physical therapist in the Milwaukee area. Bob, let's talk about Pettit here. You've trained athletes at the Pettit National Ice Center. Short Track Junior Achievement Camp kicks off there today. How important is this facility to the sport of speed skating?
Well, it's one of only two indoor 400-meter tracks in the United States, the other one in Salt Lake City. So it's extremely important for development and getting new kids into the sport. So it's essential.
With a development camp like this, can you spot rising talent? Can you spot potential Olympians at camps like this?
Well, you certainly can spot good little skaters. So you can spot like, oh, wow, that's very, very good technique. And so you should really be doing this more often. So, but as far as picking an Olympian, that's a little bit too much crystal ball.
Jordan, you know, I'm just curious, what do you think about as you're gliding over 30 miles an hour toward the finish line? What's happening in your brain?
Not much. Not really thinking of anything, especially from going as hard as I can. But, you know, just trying to think about my technique and I guess more of my feeling for the ice. But when I'm going to like the second turn of a 500, I'm not really trying to think about anything, because I don't want to lose concentration on the boards. So,
Bob, is that about right, that it's really about the muscle movement and what has happened over and over in practice? Muscle memory.
Yes, it's doing millions of repetitions, so you don't have to think about that. You're trying to think of a few things to change things. But the other thing is too is that he's approaching 40 miles an hour, so you better be really, really honed in on your body movements.
Yes, because, you know, as spectators, we're just holding our breath because, slamming into the boards and those wipeouts look just so treacherous and painful. What tips do you have for the speed skaters, or how do you negotiate those falls?
Well, the skaters who they don't fall very often, thank God. And when they do, there's a little bit of mental having to overcome it, but they're all such phenomenal athletes that I think they just get up and go again. And I know he took a really bad fall last year in Holland at one of the World Cups, and I didn't see any. There was no hesitation on the very next corner at all. So,
Jordan, what can you say about mm-hmm. bad falls? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, totally unexpected. And I guess once I hit the boards, you kind of know it happens, but you're not really freaking out until, I guess, I mean, you don't really freak out. You just try and put it out of your mind what happened. I mean, you try and find the cause and try and fix it, which is what we did. So, but it was also partly the ice condition there. They didn't resurface after the women's 1500 meter. So what happens is the ice gets really chewed up from all the skates going on it. And then the blade just happened to go right into one of the ruts, and my boot kind of booted out of it. So that caused me to go down. So for the next day of racing, I guess it's a little bit of a worry because you don't know quite why you fell the day before, but you just have to put it out of your mind because you can't have any nervousness going into a 500 meter, which was the next day.
Let's talk about the Winter Olympics debut in Beijing last year, finishing 13th in the men's 500 meters, 14th mm-hmm. in the 1,000 meters. What have you learned from those performances?
I think I learned how to deal with the environment, especially being in China. Being at different races, you have to do certain things to prepare your body for the races, and I think that was definitely a huge learning experience. They also had the ice really different there, and I think learning how to get used to different conditions on the track was something that I learned taking into the season, especially with traveling all over. And I guess my placement was all right for the first Olympics. I think I was skating a bit better earlier in the season, but still happy with my placement at the first Olympics. So.
Jordan Stolz, their world champion speed skater, Wisconsin native, Coach Bob Corby along here as well, former U.S. Olympic speed skating coach. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Bob, is there a lot of variation in the ice itself, and what causes that variation?
Usually it's the temperature at which they run their refrigerant through underneath the pipes underneath the ice. Mm. And some rinks choose to run it very cold and some choose to run it a little bit warmer. And so that's the biggest thing. And then there's humidity in the building and different things like that. But it's amazing that I can't tell the difference. I'm not nearly as talented as he is, but he knows right away, like what's going on with the ice. And, or he just knows something is different. Then usually when we find out what's going on with the temperatures, that justifies his thoughts of like, yes, it really was different.
Let's take a call. Sue in Appleton is here. Hi, Sue.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. My two sons speed skated back in the 70s and 80s, and we were associated with the Waupaca Speed Skating Club. Even though we live in Appleton, they didn't have speed skating clubs in every city. But we skated on the Shadow Lake in Waupaca, and had to prepare our own ice. And those were the days when you had ice. In December, they had a big meet. And everybody was hoping that the ice would be skatable by December, and it was back then. And we also skated in Milwaukee for various meets, Oconomowoc, like your guest was saying, indoors and outdoors. And I remember when my son crashed at an indoor meet in Appleton, and he still has a back and a hip problem from a crash a long time ago. Yeah. Mm.
Sue, thank you for calling in and sharing those memories. Bob, how does the sport evolve over the decades? We heard about preparing ice in December and about speed skating clubs.
Yes. Back in the day, back in the 60s and 70s, there pretty much was only outdoor ice, only natural ice. The old rink, the Olympic rink that was opened, was the first refrigerated 400 meter track. Mm. in the United States, and was that way until the Calgary built their track. So yeah, it was a lot different back in those days when you had to deal with skating in the elements. It was really, really much. This is much, much better now when you don't have to worry about skating into a 30-mile-an-hour wind.
Well, I want to just give a shout out here. Patrick in Milwaukee wants to say to you, Jordan, that more people mm-hmm. are tuning in and watching speed skating because of your work, and very proud. All right. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kate.
Jordan Stoles, Olympic and world champion speed skater, Keewaskum native. Bob Corby, former U.S. Olympic speed skating coach and Jordan Stoltz's current coach. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Wisconsin Interscholastic Athletic Association approves a plan that could significantly alter the landscape of competition for middle school and high school sports. Be part of the discussion. Call in with your questions, your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Michelle Guyant-Holloway is athletic director at Wauwatosa East High School, co-chair of the Wisconsin Interscholastic Athletic Association's Competitive Balance Task Force. Michelle, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you very much, Kate. I appreciate you having me.
So here in last month in April, the members approved this competitive balance plan to take effect in the 2024-2025 school year. What concerns is this plan seeking to address in sports?
Well, there has been some membership thoughts that there has been some possible competitive imbalance in our school, particularly when it comes to the tournament series. And it was addressed back in 2014 with a success factor plan that failed at that time. And back in 2021, the Board of Control had the WIA staff move forward with creating a competitive balance ad hoc committee to examine the situation again at this point in time. And so that's kind of where we started from.
So competitive balance, that terminology may be new or a little bit unclear, confusing. How do you best describe it?
It's trying to be able to provide as fair and chance for schools to have an opportunity to be able to compete in the tournament series. It used to be referred to as competitive equity. It's now been called competitive balance. And really the idea and the thought was, you know, we're making it as fair and as equitable as possible for schools, because the perception out there was that some schools have more of an advantage and others have a disadvantage. And we felt that then looking and examining this competitive balance of being able to try to, you know, in a sense, give that balance, give that fairness to everyone.
So take us into the plan here and how it awards points to teams for being successful in state tournaments. How does that work, and how do you anticipate teams could be moved up or down divisions?
Sure. That point system was really a part of the initial plan back in 2014 that I mentioned. And so the points would be looking at a three-year timetable for each particular sport. So let's just say girls basketball, for an example. A school would then be looked at for their 3 years, and if they had success in the postseason tournament, in the tournament series, then they're going to get accumulated certain points ranging from one for sectional advancement all the way up to 4 points for winning the state tournament. And so over those 3 years, these points will be added. And let's say in 2 years' time, they won a state championship. And then the next year, they were runners-up. So they've accumulated at that point 4 points for winning the state tournament and 3 points for getting to the state tournament game. They've then accumulated 7 points. And then they will have advanced over those 6 points. That next year, then, they would be promoted up to a different division. So if they were, this was a girls basketball team that won a state tournament 1 year and took second the next year at, say, Division III, then they would be promoted up to the Division II level in order for their competition because of their performances at the state tournament.
So that is an example of a promotion going up a division. What about the other way, moving down a division?
For moving down a division, if we're just talking about from the points theory, certainly there is there'll be a running total as well, too, of those points. So let's say that third year, they, you know, still advanced. And maybe they, you know, went to the state tournament, but they didn't win a game at the state tournament. So they'll still accumulate a couple of points. They'll accumulate 2 points. But then the next year after that, they don't advance to the state tournament. Mm-hmm. And then the next year after that, they don't. So they haven't accumulated points in those next years. Then they would be rolled down, moved down once they have any points less than those 6 points a total. So it'll be a running total for schools to move down to be able to make sure that they can move down in a quicker fashion. That was the goal for the committee was to be able to have them be able to move down. If we're just talking of just the point system itself, that they would be able to move down in a faster rate. So as soon as they drop below 6 points, that's girls basketball team at Division III that moved up to two, then they're going to move down.
So what happens to the spirit and the tradition? Like, for instance, you mentioned basketball, but, you know, in football, what happens to these longtime rivalries if schools move divisions?
It has nothing to do with anything that they'll do during the school year.
Okay.
That this just strictly has to deal with come the championship or the tournament series after the regular season is done. So anything within the normal regular season, this does not affect that.
And in terms of geography, if your team is moving divisions and having to travel greater distances, would that strain budgets? Is that a concern?
That's a really good question. We felt that there in our state that we have a lot of divisions that are nearby each other, in a sense. So if we're looking at, you know, Northwest Wisconsin, there's a lot of Division II, Division III, Division IV schools already that encompass that area. So if a school moves from a Division IV to a Division III, there may be a little bit additional travel, but we don't feel that there's going to be anything that's going to be dramatic. We even still sometimes have it within the current division format where a school has a two-hour drive and they try to find a location in the middle, even right now with how the tournament structure is. So I don't believe that we felt that there is going to be anything greater than what we already currently have to do sometimes.
Michelle Guyant-Holloway with us, co-chair of the Wisconsin Interscholastic Athletic Association's Competitive Balance Task Force, explaining how competitive balance will be working in our state. You can join in on these new rules of competition for middle and high school sports, 800-642-1234 to join in with your question. Michelle, the plan would apply to individual sports at schools rather than being school-wide or district-wide. Does that approach give teams a better shot at advancing in state tournaments?
That's where we felt that it is such an individual sport related. Obviously, as a school, you know, there can be some programs that have some very good success in certain sports within their school, but then others that are not as successful. And so when you just target each individual sport, it gives that a more overarching opportunity for schools to be able to address what is more specific within that sport. So we did believe that will be gives a little bit more flexibility and more opportunity for schools to make those decisions as to what sports maybe are in need of some assistance. And that's where, you know, the request aspect that's part of this plan allows that opportunity for a school. So if there's a school that has some big enrollment drop that's coming up, they're in a rural area, so they don't have a lot of students to, you know, kind of in a sense choose from, and if they need some relief, that they're able to ask for that in the request process of this particular plan. So that's why we wanted to keep it very more individualized for each sport to be able to have their opportunity for, you know, kind of being able to rectify whatever problems or issues that they have that they feel that they need to move down a division.
And is that like an appeals process? You know, on what grounds can a school appeal being moved up or down in the level of competition?
So the request process, as I just mentioned, is at the very beginning part of this seven-step plan. So any school is able to, at the very beginning, after enrollments are determined, can ask for assistance, can ask for a request.
Okay.
And that's to move up or down. Some schools may want to move up, knowing that they have you know, better competition, and they want to be able to move up division. Or as I mentioned, if there's a school that's struggling and has some certain areas that they can address, that they are able to move down. And we have 8 criteria that's listed to be able to have that school stay. These are some of the reasons as to why we need to move down. The same 8 criteria that's used for the request process is once we get the tournament performance point system in place, those schools that then are affected and have been promoted up due to their tournament performance factor points, they will have an opportunity to appeal. We have a classification committee that is formed, and they will be able to make that appeal to the committee as to why that they shouldn't, even though they have more than the 6 points, why they shouldn't be moved up a division. So we have these 2 processes in place for either requesting for schools to move up or down, or after the tournament performance factor points are applied, a school is able to appeal and state their case as to why they feel that they shouldn't be moved up.
Michelle Guyant-Holloway is athletic director at Wauwatosa East High School, co-chairs the Wisconsin Interscholastic Athletic Association's Competitive Balance Task Force. Call in with questions or comments at any point, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We examine the new competitive balance plan moving forward for high school sports and efforts to help schools be competitive in tournament play. Call in with your questions, your thoughts, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Michelle Guyant-Holloway is athletic director at Wauwatosa East High School, co-chairs the Wisconsin Interscholastic Athletic Association's Competitive Balance Task Force. So, Michelle, a bit of that history you touched on, that this is the second time around for the WIAA attempting to address competitive balance. The 2015 plan was voted down by the organization's membership. What is different this time around?
That's a great question, Kate, and we were very conscious of that as we were formed when we were started off on this this journey. And the biggest differences are the two items that I just spoke about in regards to the request and to the appeals process. We felt that there was a need for schools to be able to have a strong opportunity to request. Everyone's got disparate situations at their schools and with certain sports. And so the request process was really a key item to have at the beginning parts of the stages. And we were able to look at different states, and while we were creating this plan, and the criteria really came about from the Colorado and their plan that they've instituted just within the last few years itself. And then the appeal process, we really felt that we wanted our schools to be able to have an opportunity that even after they were moved up for their performance factors in the tournament, that they still have an opportunity to state, well, maybe this upcoming year, we have had a change, and there's things that have happened within our school, or we see a trend that's changing here, and we don't feel that we should be able to stay in this upper division at this point in time. And so we wanted to give them that opportunity to state their case and make that appeal, be able to go to the committee. So those two were the real big key changes.
I wonder, will this require more regulatory work from the WIAA?
Well, the classification committee is going to be the group that's going to be hearing the requests and the appeals from the schools. We felt that it was wanting the membership to be able to have part of that process and not putting it onto strictly the WIA's shoulders, the staff members up there. That's where sometimes I think we've learned in the past that may have hindered some relationships. And so if we come at it from our membership is working with our other membership, that was, a better fit. So we have anywhere between 15 to 20 people being superintendents, district administrators, principals, athletic directors that will be part of this classification committee that then will hear all these appeals and requests and be able to make that decision that way. Certainly the WIA will have a staff member that will be a liaison that will work with the classification committee. But very similar to what we have in our conference realignment, that committee, they listen, they hear, and then they make their changes. The classification committee will do the same. They'll be addressing and listening to those requests and appeals.
Let's bring on a call now. Joe in Platteville is here. Joe, hi.
Hello. Doug Chickering, when he was head of WIA, looked into a point system to try to even out the private schools who recruit and really were able to do a lot in the state tournament. And what he found in Illinois, they had that point system, and it just made them win more championships because they were so good that they spread out in all the divisions and just kept winning. Even though they put them up a division, it didn't matter. They'd still won.
Is that point system still in effect in Illinois, Joe? Do you know?
Sure. Doug Chickering was the head of WIA quite a while ago, but that's what he told us at a coaching clinic, that the point system they had in Illinois made the private schools have more championships instead of evening out the competition.
Michelle, what are your insights there?
I was not around as a high school athletic director at that time when Doug Chickering was the head of the WIA. So to that specific idea at that time, I can't address that. But I can address that, when we examined the first group in 2014, 2015, looked and examined that, this point system came from Indiana. At that time, and looked at that where it was successful. It was an opportunity to be able to, regardless of what school, if you were successful in the tournament, that you were going to have these points be able to be added and addressed that way. And we've had success from a lot of our state tournaments being from a variety of schools, small, large, rural, urban, private, public. So we felt that having a point system at this point in time still was maybe more relative than at that point. Again, I can't address the idea was at that time, but we feel that this was still a value even in today's time.
Michelle Guyant-Holloway, co-chair of the Wisconsin Interscholastic Athletic Association's Competitive Balance Task Force. Let's go to Keegan in Minocqua. Keegan, hi.
Hi. My question is more about team individual sports like wrestling, swimming, and track, where certain athletes can go to state, but maybe not the whole team. And I was wondering if this point system has an effect on those types of sports.
Yeah, that's a great question. We had, as a committee, we actually created a subcommittee with many of the athletic directors that were on the committee to examine the point system structure. And we broke it down into bracketed sports, which are your more traditional team sports of wrestling, basketball, hockey, soccer, and so forth. And then the non-bracketed sports were categorized in another area, your cross country, your golf, your tennis, because of the nature of how those sports are created once they come into the tournament series. We saw a distinction between those types of sports of those that are in a bracket that are traditional in the tournament series to those that are in a non-bracket, even in that sense, so that it was be able to have a distinction between those because they are different formats at that point in time. And so even though the point systems of 1 through 4 that schools would still be or sports programs would still be accumulating, it is a little bit different, for those non-bracketed sports. So for an example, for cross country, if a team qualifies for the state meet, they're going to get 1 point. Whereas in a bracketed sport, the team is going to advance to the state quarterfinal or their sectional final. Or for football, if they get to level 3, they're going to earn that point at that point in time. So we did have a distinction between those bracketed and those non-bracketed sports.
Well, Michelle, we appreciate your help in helping us understand this. Thank you so much for joining us.
I appreciate your time. I'm reaching out and discussing this this topic, and thank you so much, Kate, for having me on.
Michelle Guyant-Holloway is athletic director at Wauwatosa East High School and co-chair of the Wisconsin Interscholastic Athletic Association's Competitive Balance Task Force. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.